The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So what I'd like to do as a Dharma talk today is to give you a condensed version of the talks I gave at the retreat. I gave about 10 talks, and on the topic of liberative dependent origination. And this is a very significant teaching, and I would like to kind of present it to you here. And I start with an analogy, and that is that if you are lost in the woods, or let's say a few people are lost in the woods, and it's a dangerous woods to be in, and they're lost for a long time, maybe years, and one person, and then eventually they get out of the woods, they're free of the woods, and then they go out and live their lives. You ask them the question, what is it like to be free of the woods? They can answer two ways. They can answer, oh, we're no longer in the dark, we're no longer where there's tigers and serpents and all these dangers, and you know, we're no longer kind of caught under the canopy, and now we're free of that. And all the people who managed to get out of the woods can report the same thing about what they're free from. If they want to describe what being free of the woods is like in terms of how they live their lives afterwards, each of those people is going to describe something different because they're going to go off and do different things with their lives. And so their experience of their freedom of the woods is going to be different depending on many, many circumstances. So to ask someone, what is your experience of freedom like? If they answer positively how they're living a life and their experience of life now, it may or may not relate to how you're going to experience freedom. But if you talk about what you're free from, then everyone shares the same thing, in terms of Buddhism at least. And what the Buddha did over and over again is he preferred to talk about what we're freed from, and not the life that we live as a result of that freedom. And one of the reasons for that is that if you understand what you're freed from really well, then you can teach other people how to be free of it. So, say there are two people who are stuck in the woods for a long time, and one of them stumbles out. And the other one studies the woods really carefully, understands the nature of the woods, and understands what the path and what is the way to find your way out of the woods is. When those two people get free of the woods, the one who stumbled out is not going to be able to teach anybody else how to get out. Just walk around a lot. The person who kind of studied and understood the process of getting out of the woods could then teach that to other people so they can get out of the woods as well. So in the path of liberation that the Buddha taught, the path does not end with liberation. It ends with understanding, knowledge. The word is knowledge. Knowledge of what has been left behind, of what has been let go of, and what that process is that brings you to liberation. Being liberated is not enough, especially if you want to be able to help other people and share it with other people. So if what you want to do is to kind of understand that process, then and support other people. So the Buddha was someone who understood that process. In fact, he couldn't become a teacher without having understood the process that brought him to liberation. And he spent a long time describing what that process is like, insisting that it's a process. He called it a gradual process, a gradual path of unfolding. And so what this teaching on liberative dependent origination is one way, one description of that process. It shouldn't be taken as absolute because there's other descriptions as well. But it's one, and the advantage of this description is it describes the dependent conditions that supporting conditions that step by step support that process of liberation. With the idea that liberation doesn't happen out of the blue, it's supported, but it only occurs when certain conditions, dependent conditions, are in place that allow for that experience to happen. So if you're stuck in the woods, if you sit on a rock all the time, you're not going to get free. Even if you're not going to even stumble out of the woods, if you just sit on that rock, you're going to have to kind of at least, it's dependent on walking around and, you know, walking around, stumbling around at the minimum. Maybe it's going to depend on studying the terrain. A number of things are needed in order for you to get out of the woods. So to continue with the analogy of the woods, in order to kind of finally find your way out of the woods, one of the kind of dependent conditions might be that you start noticing where the woods begin to thin out, where the trees begin to thin out. And the thinning of the woods, so, oh, where it thins out, that's probably where I'm getting to a place where there's going to be less and less, and eventually we're out of the woods. So that thinning is important. It's also important not to get sidetracked by all the allure and promise and dangers of the woods. There might be some amazingly enchanted clearings in the woods. And you go into those clearings and you, wow, this is the best. And you never want to leave because it's so enchanted. Or there might be some amazing dangers. They say, oh, I can't go any further. I can't face those dangers. I better pull back and go deeper in the woods in the dark and hide. Or there may be many things in the woods that may keep you there. So one of the things that needs to happen is they have to have certain kind of understanding or wisdom not to get enchanted or not to get caught by the different things you encounter in the woods. And that requires being able to understand clearly the nature of what you encounter as you go along. To understand, oh, the enchanted little clearing is not that desirable. It doesn't create safety, it doesn't create lasting happiness, it's not that useful place to be. The dangers, it's best not to just recoil from the dangers and hide, because that's not going to be helpful either. There has to be some clear understanding about the nature of what we encounter when we're in the woods, so we can keep going along. If you want to clearly understand the nature of what you encounter in the woods, it helps that you have a relatively stable, calm mind. Because if you're agitated, you can't really understand what you're seeing. So you need to have some stability and calmness, tranquility of mind, in order to be able to do that work. The other thing you're going to need is you're going to need to have some confidence that there is a way out of the woods. Because if you felt absolutely had confidence that there's no way out of the woods, why bother? So there has to be some confidence there's a way out, there's a path that you can find your way. And the last thing that you need is some understanding that being stuck in the woods is not a good thing. Finding the path out of the woods is dependent on realizing that being stuck in the woods is not a good thing. Okay? So, that's the analogy. And now, there's 12 steps in liberative dependent origination. And don't get hung up that it's linear so much. But they could describe some of the kind of processes that come into play as someone engages in Buddhist practice. They're not necessarily conscious choices. There could be the byproducts of doing the practice. So the first, in order to find a path, the Buddhist path, the first thing that has to, that is said to be the condition around which the path arises, or engaging the path arises, is suffering. And so this liberative path is dependent on the presence of suffering. It's another way of saying that it's not good to be stuck in the woods. So we have to see our suffering, and Buddhism puts tremendous value on really having insight, understanding for our suffering. As the bumper sticker says, I stop for suffering. Not because we're going to suffer better, but by stopping for suffering, we can really engage and understand what it's about, and be inspired, hopefully, to take a path to become free of suffering. But if you don't know you're suffering, why would you follow a path to freedom from suffering? So the path is dependent on suffering. Those of you who don't suffer, don't have to hear the rest of this talk. Then, with awareness of our suffering as the first condition, that condition is the condition, supporting condition for the arising of faith or confidence. So confidence that there's a way out of the woods. Confidence that there is a path. Confidence that we can do something to address the suffering. And this is very meaningful for all of us, because without some degree of confidence that there's a path, there's a way, we're not going to apply ourselves or engage or take responsibility for creating the path for ourselves. Then the Buddha said that with confidence or faith as the supporting condition, there can arise delight. So only two steps away from suffering is delight. And some of the things that delight means here is delight that there is a path, there is a way. Delight that we can walk a path, we found a path, there's a way of exploring and developing and going. And hopefully that gives us some kind of appreciation, some delight, some something. Then, based on that delight and beginning to walk the path, there is joy. The joy of actually, so delight means more appreciation. Delight means more like, oh, you see the possibility. Joy is what arises as we begin engaging in that possibility, following through on it, walking the path. There's a certain kind of different kind of well-being that arises that the Buddha called joy. And there's many different kinds of delight and joy, but as we begin to walk the path, and it's a reminder that the Buddhist path is meant to be to bring a sense of well-being. And it's supposed to be bring a sense of well-being relatively early as you walk the path. It's not meant to be a path that lets you linger in suffering, that there's a kind of noble suffering that you're supposed to suffer, it's good for you to suffer. There's this honest confrontation with suffering with the hope and expectation that it lightens you up. And it's quite inspiring to go to countries like Thailand and Southeast Asia and encounter people who have encountered suffering and experience their joy, the light way they hold that. They say, oh, that's suffering, and they smile. what do you expect? It's kind of like, oh, life comes with suffering. There it is. And rather than being oppressed by the suffering, there's a way of recognizing it that actually can help us behold it lighter, not be so take it so personally or weighed down by it. Oh yeah, of course, suffering. So if you get a flat tire in your car, that's a drag. But in Thailand, some people will look at the flat tire and say, oh yeah, of course, suffering. Things are impermanent. Anyway, so joy. So, dependent on the presence of suffering, there can arise faith in a way out of suffering. Dependent on having that faith or that confidence, there can be delight. Dependent on that delight and following the path, there can arise joy. Then the Buddha said, dependent on that joy, that sense of well-being, there can arise tranquility, to be calm. So the joy of Buddhism is one that's supposed to transform itself into a certain kind of serene joy, calm joy, tranquil joy. Tranquility is very important in Buddhism because in order to be able to see clearly, and that's really the call of Buddhist practice, is to learn to see clearly for yourself, not to believe something on faith, but really to go beyond belief, to really seeing. The reason for that is only by seeing can you do the deep work of uprooting inside of yourself the places, the attachments, the clingings that bring about our suffering. So there needs to be some tranquility, some ease of mind that happens. Based on that tranquility, the Buddha said, that's a supporting condition for the arising of happiness. And so you see this wonderful interplay between these different factors here. And so here, As the joy gets transformed into kind of tranquility, that tranquility sets the stage for the possibility of some deep abiding happiness. The difference between joy and happiness in Buddhism is that joy is much more mental. It's like a mental excitation over something that can be quite intense. It can get up to the point of feeling rapturous. But happiness, the mind is going to become tranquil. And so the mind tranquil, the mind is not excited, and that kind of rapturous joy doesn't occur. But rather there's a kind of very sublime, or somewhat sublime, sense of well-being that permeates the body. It's kind of a deep embodied sense of pleasure that's much more satisfying than the joy. And this kind of deeper pleasure or satisfaction in the body is called happiness. But it requires this tranquility to be the tranquilizing of the mental excitation of joy. Can you believe it? So, and then with that happiness, that tranquil happiness as the supporting condition, there can arise concentration. Many Buddhists have tried to get concentrated while they're unhappy and tense. And guess what? It's not, even if you do get concentrated, it's not a very useful concentration that way. That the concentration that the Buddha was encouraging was one that arose from a sense of well-being. You develop a sense of well-being, calmness, ease, well-being, as a supporting condition for getting concentrated. So a big part of Buddha's training is has to do with creating the conditions for a sense of some modicum of well-being and happiness. So things like following the precepts, living ethically, practicing generosity, hanging out with good spiritual friends. A variety of things are supportive for that process of developing inner well-being. Then as the mind gets concentrated, that's the dependent condition or the supporting condition for being able to see clearly, seeing things as they are. So if you want to see something with a telescope far in the distance, you better have a tripod, because otherwise you can't really see the moon, you know, because your hand moves so much. With a tripod, the telescope is stable and you can really see. I suppose same thing with a microscope. If you hold the microscope in your hand and kind of try to look at, you know, the cells, it's not going to work so well. The microscope has to be still. So the same way, our mind needs to have some real stability in order to really look deep into the structures of our beliefs, structures of our psychology, how we work. But in particular, the foundation stones of clinging and attachment, which is often the foundation for the edifice of self-attachment, self-centeredness, greed, hate, fear, anxiety that many people have. So, and seeing things as they are is very important. As we see things as they are, as we understand better the nature of this world and ourselves, that gives birth to wisdom, to understanding the nature of this life that we live in. So we understand, this is just a little clearing in the woods. It's a nice place to rest, but I don't want to get stuck there. This thing that I thought was so wonderful is actually kind of dangerous. You can grab onto a branch in the woods to kind of pull you over a stream, only to discover it's a python that's hanging there. When I was in Thailand, I was in the jungle there, and it was dusk, and there was a 6-foot-wide road, and there was a branch that had fallen from a tree and was laying across that road. And so I was walking along, and I just stepped on the branch, and the branch moved. It was a 6-foot snake. Boy, did I jump. So, it's good to be able to see these things before you step on them. So, that's not safe to, And so, as we see things more clearly, the Buddha said we become, then allows us to become disenchanted. It's a very important word in Buddhism, the idea of becoming disenchanted. Disenchanted means that we're no longer under the spell or the trance of things in the world. Now, it's not a rejection of things in the world. It's not saying that things in the world are bad. But if you're living under the spell, under a trance, in relationship to them, you probably get in trouble. Some people are entranced by money. Some people are entranced by status. Some people are entranced by, you know, by their homes. Some people are entranced by the whole world of relationships. There's all kinds of trances people have, which means kind of real, it's powerful preoccupations that doesn't allow us to see clearly what's really important in this life. And so seeing clearly helps us to break the trance, break the spell, and that in Buddhism is called disenchantment, no longer enchanted. As we become disenchanted with the things we cling to, then the clinging begins to lessen. And then there's a fading away, a thinning out of clinging and attachment. So as we get to the edge of the woods, the trees begin to thin out. So as we begin to wisdom begins to operate, and we start seeing more clearly what's here, then there starts to be a thinning out of our clinging and attachment. They get thinner and thinner, more and more transparent. And this is a very important point, because plenty of Buddhist practitioners are under the enchanted idea that of kind of the Big Bang experience of Buddhism, like it's all or nothing. Like I have this attachment, and there's somehow I have to, if I'm going to do it right, I have to just kind of push that button in my mind, and you know, it's all over. You know, I'm free once and for all. And I think a much more mature approach to Buddhist practice is that Buddhist practice is a gradual process of maturation. And rather than suddenly being able to let go of our clinging, letting go of our faults and our problems, they get thinner and thinner. They get weaker and weaker the more we practice. And then at some point, they get weak enough that they just dissolve. They end. So the Buddha called this viraga. Viraga in one translation means dispassion. So based on the wisdom that gets us disenchanted, we become more and more dispassionate. Or in the traditional English definition of disinterested, we become disinterested. Disinterested, like a disinterested party, that kind of disinterested, disinterested party where you, the original meaning of the word was, you know, you no longer had this drive or this attachment or this bias involved in what you did. The word that's used for dispassion in Pali also means fading away. So it's a sort of fading away. When things get faded away enough, when our attachments get thin enough that they dissolve, then liberation occurs. We uproot and get freed from the attachments, the clinging that kept us in the woods. And then, if you look back at that process, once you get liberated, look back and understand how that process happens, you understand how that process arose or happened in independence on a variety of factors. So that's why it's called dependent origination. And the key insight, the key core insight that the Buddha had, night of his awakening, was into the whole world of how things exist, independence and other things. And it's meant to be the good news, because as you understand how things exist in dependence, that means you can do something about it. You can change the dependent conditions. Suffering exists in dependence on certain conditions, and liberation exists in dependence on certain conditions. And so, which conditions do you create and reinforce in your life? And if you support those conditions that support suffering, you'll get more suffering. If you support those conditions and create those conditions that support liberation, you'll get more liberation. I think it's important as we think about liberation in this process, again, it's not an all or nothing kind of thing, but rather all of us get liberated all the time in small ways. I'm quite confident that all of you have become liberated from certain things that you were attached to in the past. I certainly hope so. Because my 6-year-old son, he has certain attachments that I'm pretty confident will pass pretty quickly. Like for him, how the dinner plate is placed on the table and how the maple syrup this morning was poured on the waffles, and the fact that the maple syrup should not, absolutely not fall in the cracks between the waffles. I mean, this is something that's, you know, immensely significant and important for him. And he's very attached to this. And I'm pretty confident that if I can do my job as a parent, that within probably 10 or 15 years, he won't be so attached to where his maple syrup goes and where the plate exactly fits. So I imagine that you also have been liberated from certain things that you were caught up in when you were kids or when you were teenagers, you know. Just think back when you were teens or when you were in your 20s or 30s or whenever. And I think it's so you can, already there are ways in which you've been freed by certain things from certain attachments and clingings. As you find yourself freed from particular things that you're clinging to, attached to, don't stop there. Don't rest on your laurels. But rather, do that last step that the Buddha encouraged. Look back, reflect back, understand a little bit about the nature of that clinging, and a little bit about what helped you become free of that clinging. Was there wisdom operating? Was there disenchantment? You know, for me, I was really preoccupied with my zits in high school. And at some point, I became disenchanted with what having or not having zits was going to do for my happiness. So to look back and have developed some understanding about what that process was like, what helped you and supported you, that led you to letting go. Because if you can do that last step of developing understanding, I think it helps with your maturation, helps with your wisdom, and helps you in the future to do the process more effectively next time, or in other areas, or eventually in the really difficult areas. And I think all of us have really difficult areas of clinging, of attachment, that are really challenging to face and deal with. So the Buddha offered that process. It's called the 12-fold step of liberative dependent origination. So, I feel a little bit apologetic to go through such a long list. You don't have to memorize it. So thank you very much, and I hope that you have a wonderful potluck here, those of you who stay, and please stay. Those of you who are new, and if some of you are new and would like to say hello to some people, if people here are friendly, you just have to turn to someone. And please feel welcome into our community. Thank you.